may wonder why the flower. This is in honor of the father of all laws and codes, Hammurabi, king of Babylonia, who lived 2000 B.C., and whose wisdom has descended to us in a number of ways. One through the Justinian Code that followed, one through the English Bill of Rights, the Common Law of England, and the American Bill of Rights. They are all derived essentially from a code established 4,000 years ago. Most people don't realize this, and they also do not realize the tragedies that have separated the original from the present time. The code has been so mutilated that it is difficult to recognize it in these days. But in the original, it was really a document that should be restudied very soon by those interested in improving the general conditions of mankind. Hammurabi was a man of his day. He was a very powerful monarch. He was a ruler over several nations, most of them in the valley of the Euphrates. His original code was in cuneiform. It has been lost. It was variously transcribed in early times, and one or two of these translations and transcriptions have descended to us. I think one of the most important things in the code was his division of human society into three essential groups with the corresponding and appropriate responsibilities. He used the term aristocracy to represent the privileged class of people, the wealthy, the powerful, and the influential. He used the term the citizenry for all levels of people working in professions, art, crafts, and trades. And he used the idea of serfs or slaves for those a more humble estate. But the first thing that he did was to make this sound strange, but upon a second thought to realize how neatly he had phrased the circumstance. His law was this: the class with the greatest authority had the greatest responsibility. Also, the sins of the great were much more dangerous and deep and terrible than the sins of the lowly. He said that the individual who had much, knew much, possessed much, had a greater duty to the state, to his God, and to his fellow man. And if he committed a crime, his punishment should be much greater than that bestowed upon the humble. In other words, every step upward is a step in burden of responsibility, greater need for maturity of thought, and absolute need for honesty. And the crimes of the great are far more dangerous to themselves and the world than the crimes of the humble. This was one of his first givens. This was his first classification as to where responsibility should be placed. The second group he declared to have inalienable rights. The Code of Hammurabi says that all three divisions of society have inalienable rights before God and man, and that these rights cannot be transgressed without danger to the social system to which they belong. Another point that was interesting is in his legal code was that in cases involving litigation, no lawyers were to be permitted in the court. Every person in litigation had to plead his own case in person. He might bring in witnesses to support him, documents if available, and both sides were permitted to have their say. But neither side was to be represented by learned counsel. Each one had to tell his story in his own words, for this was the only way that justice could be attained. if by any chance or circumstance the disputing parties were uncertain or unsettled, or the judgment seemed unfair, Hammurabi said, there is one final court of appeal. That's me. Any person, bond or free, aristocrat or slave, who feel that they are improperly treated and cannot get redress in the common courts, can petition to come to me, and I will see them, no matter who they are. I will see the slave or the serf just as quickly as anyone else. And I will be accompanied by learned people who can cover areas of knowledge in which I might be deficient. Every effort will be made to see that justice is fair to all concerned, and all unfairness and ulterior motives are punishable by law. Now, this is putting it pretty straight. Then, of course, he had, in those days, it was perfectly proper and considered right to keep slaves. Now came the rights and privileges of slaves. They had inalienable rights that could not be transgressed. They had the right of being treated reasonably, fairly, pleasantly for their entire period. They had the right to petition against any injustice. They had to have good living conditions, good food, a proper opportunity to grow, and if they wanted education, it could be granted to them, if they wanted it. If a slave became obviously superior to his position, the state could purchase him and free him. If it did not do that, the master of the slave was invited to donate him to the state. He was then put in school, educated, and taught in whatever the branch of learning he was naturally inclined to, and made an equal to all other men. There was no such a thing as a slave who could be mistreated in any way. He had to be regarded as a person. He had to be given all necessary care and attention. And if he desired education, cultural advantage, or freedom of religion, it was granted to him. And for unusual achievements, he was freed. This was the way it was, and he says in the code, or in the commentary on it, that a great many nobles or aristocrats freed their slaves on their deathbed, that is, on the deathbed of the noble. He freed his slaves before he died. He was probably one of the first to bring this point out, and it might be known or mentioned that one of the last acts of George Washington was to free his slaves. That goes back 4,000 years in the literary and cultural history of mankind. Another very important rule or part of the doctrine of Hammurabi was the responsibility of artisans to each other and to the state. When one private citizen cheated another private citizen, he damaged the state, and that was all there was to it. If he did not keep his contracts, if he used inferior materials, if he overcharged, these were not things to be passed over as merely competition. They were subject to punishment. And a house that was badly built and was not up to the proper qualifications as specified and gave trouble could be torn down and rebuilt at the expense of the people who built it. If the carpenters did it, they would have to do it over again at their own expense. Nothing could be promised that was not fulfilled, and the fulfillment had to be according to the promise. There was no need for bonds because the state was the bond for all of it. The state bonded each citizen. If the citizen was right, the state supported him. If he was wrong, the state sentenced him accordingly. Actually, also, there were many other very curious and interesting phases in this problem. One of the phases that I think we are all more or less interested in today with our present problems is the difficulties with families. Actually, the code of Hammurabi goes right down into the private home of the citizens. In the code of Hammurabi, women had exactly the same legal privileges as men, could own their own property. When they married, the husband did not have the right to use his wife's property except by a personal request by herself. She had court appeal at any and all time. And if there was a divorce, which could be granted according to the code, under normal circumstances, the children in all cases were placed in the custody of the mother. Also, any properties that she might have in a divorce that she brought to a marriage could be restored to her. There was no way in which a husband could claim his wife's dowry, or a wife could profit by the possessions of her husband if there was a settlement. Each person received back what they started with, and there was no profit whatsoever to be involved from a divorce. This was a pretty rigid stuff for 4,000 years ago, but it was something that worked very well as long as it was enforced. Among those who came after it was Lycurgus of Sparta. He was a code maker of somewhat lesser quality, but with very interesting peculiarities and specialties. According to Lycurgus, the basis of citizenship was frugality. Debt was forbidden by law. And the individual who overbought himself or placed himself in a position where he had to commit an unreasonable or unlawful act in order to meet his debts was found guilty, first, of his own extravagance and was properly chastised. It was the problem of Lycurgus was to keep people simple, direct, honest, and dedicated to the values and realities of life. The Justinian Code was built very largely upon the Code of Hammurabi. Then we come to another very interesting phase of the whole situation. In 1640 or thereabouts, Lord Bacon's Code for England was more or less officially regarded and stated. Actually, the common law of England was framed by Bacon. And this common law was based solidly upon the Code of Hammurabi. The common law of England took the place of jailment for debt and all this type of thing that had burdened the country for a long time. Bacon also divided the problems of knowledge into three levels: tradition, experience, and experimentation. Now, he said these are the three values upon which civilization must build. They're taken directly from antiquity. The traditional part of law is in history, and history today is the most ignored phase of human knowledge. We have become so suspicious of the integrities of our historians that we are inclined to ignore the whole subject. Yet history has to be the basis of one very great generality, namely what law is, why it functions, what it is, where it functions. Law is something, as Bacon pointed out, that is universal. Universal law is something that has nothing to do with the narrow confines of a planet. Universal law is the power, principle, and pattern by means of which existence occurs in any phase or on any level. The same thing in existence all the way through, whether it be checked through dimensions or integrities. Therefore, law is finally shown to be what it is by what it does. There is no escaping the consequences of action. And the law, therefore, is based upon the comparative consequences of various actions committed by sentient beings. These sentient beings get into all kinds of muddles and puddles, and also get themselves into difficulties, sometimes difficult to escape. But laws are there, and they say, as the cause so the consequence. As ye sow, so shall ye reap, is immutable. Now, the universal laws are the basis of the maintenance of the galaxies, of the solar systems, of the planets, and of all the little birds and bugs that exist on our planet. Everything that exists, exists under law. The Rosicrucians, following in some of these patterns, declared that there were three great textbooks of law by which we were to understand the values of life. And in the theological days, the first of these textbooks was considered to be religion. The second textbook was the planet and all the creatures that lived on it. And the third textbook was the human body. These are the basis of laws. And following Paracelsus, and to a great degree most of the alchemists, we can consider law as applicable to the human body. Now, if the human body got into a muddle, such as at present in political life, concerning the election of the next candidates for public office, if that happened in the body, it would die. If you put the body under the pressure of conflict by competition of functions, you would end the body. It couldn't survive. Yet the body probably has a larger population than China, probably a larger population than the whole earth put together and some extra earth thrown in. Because each cell, each minute living thing in the human body has, as Hammurabi would have pointed out socially, rights that cannot be violated with impunity. Every particle in space has laws. Its value to the complete pattern depends upon the right administration of those laws. If this little cell is abused and loses the power to function, it is a detriment to the cultural advancement of the total body. So the body becomes a sort of ground to look over in connection with all governments. The body has three suits of government. It has the head, the heart, and the generative system. These must work together. If the heart denies the mind denies the heart, we will have trouble. We have to give to each part of the body its proper due, and teach it through our own mental and moral pressure to keep the rules and keep the laws governing itself. Now we come today into a conflict between natural law and political law. We come into a conflict where justice is not termed in the fulfillment of law, but very largely in the fulfillment of ambition. Justice is now constantly changing the rules to adapt them to an unlawful situation. When we get a problem today, we don't go back to the code for the answer. We change the law of the moment to exonerate the person we wish to have win. This is a very serious mistake, because nature shows no favoritism of any kind, nor will it perpetuate any favoritism. Nature has also given us, however, a reasoning faculty, a power of mind, in order that we may observe and experiment with the rules of life. We know definitely that we are part of something bigger than this little world we live in now. How big this something is, we do not know. But we realize that within it we all live and move and have our being. We know that there are rules that govern the planet's motions, that there are rules that govern the materials inside of the earth. We know there are rules concerning conduct and extravagance and wrong attitudes of all kinds. We know what causes sickness of the mind, the soul, and the body. Yet our present concern is not to prevent this sickness, but to endure it and make rules to prove that the wrong is right. As a result of that, we have now an increasing crime wave such as we have never known before. And the greatest so-called progressive nations are the nations with the greatest industrial scientific advancements are in the deepest trouble. And out of all the wars of the past, and out of all the strategies and all the conflicts of antiquity, we are today nearer to a world war than we had ever been before. We are not doing the things that are right. Therefore, we have to question the procedures which bring them about. We know that whatever is happening is what we deserve. And it is rather painful to contemplate that we deserve what we deserve, but we do. And the only way to change the situation is to take a new relationship with life itself. We've got to begin to realize that we are not here to spend most of our time having fun. We are not here to run each other into bankruptcy. We are not here to dominate other countries. We are not here to compete over religious problems. We are here to live according to natural law, and that natural law is cooperation. It is that we get together and live as one family on one little ball in space. And until we do that, we're going to be in the same difficulties yesterday, today, and forever. We can't get away from this. We're trying everything we can think of. We cannot elect people to be honest for us. We have to be honest for the leaders we elect and support the right ones. We cannot connive people into political positions and then suffer from the consequences of their misdoings. We have to start with our own recognition that we have got to live within our means. And to live within our means means to live within the capacities and possibilities of the little ball we live on in space. We have a planet that has limited resources, and we have unlimited ambitions. We have a world in which there is enough, but there is not enough to be wasted constantly. We are gradually catching up to the deficiencies resulting from wanton waste, as Ben Franklin called it. For he said that wanton waste always results in woeful want. And that is exactly the situation we are in. But we are thinking of trying to solve it without changing ourselves. Little and large, we want to have our own private purposes. We want these purposes to be as selfish as we want them to be. If we want to drink ourselves to death, we declare that we have the inalienable right to do so. If we wish to be victims of narcotics, it's too bad, but that is still our right. And we have done nothing, basically, to bring the laws of the political structure into harmony with the laws of nature and the rules and regimes of common sense. This has to change, because we have now 4,000 years of written experience, recorded experience, in China, in Egypt, and in Mesopotamia, and for that matter also in the early days and years of our own Western Hemisphere. We know what happens to those who do not keep the rules. And we therefore look out upon the ruin of all the civilizations that have gone before. They have all died from the same cause, luxury and selfishness. They have all abused the natural privileges of life. They have tried to compete with each other. They have tried to lay out their own territories and take on as many other people's territory as possible. All of this, it brought every empire on earth to ruin. And in the process of doing so, it has depleted the planet of invaluable natural resources. It has impoverished us and failed utterly to bring us progress. Now, we talk about progress in terms of computers. We talk about it in terms of nuclear fission. We wish to have everybody realize that we are going further out into space than we ever did before. But here on this planet, we have millions of people dying from human selfishness. And it's just about time to find out what constitutes success. Success is not getting as much as you can. Success is having enough and using it well and giving the other person a chance. These things we are beginning to learn. But when the time comes, will we stand back of the better convictions that are coming to us every day through the mistakes that we are making? Actually, the entire problem of natural law is rounded upon one point. We are here temporarily.
Our journey here may be one of many trips, and most of antiquity accepted the doctrine of rebirth. But the point is that this little life that we have now has a limitation upon it. And we are reminded that the Druids of Britain in ancient days made documentary disposal of their goods, leaving their possessions to themselves in the next embodiment, which was a process that finally was negated out because there were no claimants. Therefore, this problem does remain, however. We are here at 75, 85, 95, 105 years. We are here on a temporary basis. And yet on a temporary basis, we are trying to build an eternal foundation. We are trying to live every day as though we would live forever. We are trying desperately to create the concept of permanent progress on a level which can never be true. The only things that we can really call progress are the changes within ourselves that give us a greater personal integrity which we can take with us into the future, wherever it may be. We no longer believe in the old doctrines of heaven and hell, but we do believe in cause and effect. And we have to cause the better world if we want it, and if we do not cause it, we will not have it. So we are thinking very much now of how we can do some of these things that are personally necessary. But to do this, we have to refocus our own attention on what is doable and what is useful. We cannot go on as we go, wrongly thinking and badly acting, and continue indefinitely. We are going to run out of planet. We are going to run out of resource. Now, our great abstract hope is that when we get through ruining this planet, we'll find another one that we can move on to. The only one that we've seen yet was worse than this, the moon. And we don't have no realization as to whether any of the others are habitable. We think they may be, but we're not sure. But right here, we have a planet that is ours to take care of. It is ours to protect. And it is something that is so useful and so valuable that we cannot afford to waste it. We all have generations to follow after us who must take up the bankruptcy which we leave behind. And this is not a pleasant thought when it comes to natural resources. There isn't a day that goes by that we are not mentioned as having become short in something. We are exploring now the polar caps to try to find some more petroleum or something of that kind. But this is Earth is a bottle. It only has certain contents. And we have no proof that any of this material will revitalize or renew itself except wood. Wood can grow again. But otherwise, all the natural resources that we have, once they are gone, they are gone. Surely they might become available again if we give them the millions of years that were used to produce the ones we are now wasting. But for the most part, when this is empty, we are finished. Now, we've got to begin to think in these terms instead of more corporations, bigger business, more progress, all in material things. We are eternal divine beings locked into a materiality that we have created for ourselves. We would hate to assume, except for a few atheists, that we are nothing and go nowhere. But at the same time, we are in an environment which we have created. An environment in which we have gradually become guilty of wasting the resources of nature. We've got to do something about it, and we've got to put this high on the list of required improvements. There's no use trying to perpetuate a situation that has brought us only what we now have. We cannot allow the world to just drift towards oblivion, because we are content to sit down 5 hours a day in front of the television show. Now, we are not doing anything with it. Education is also giving us a bad time. Education has been greatly admired, greatly talked about, and deified for years. But education's primary problem in the beginning was to keep us out of trouble, and now is to get us out of trouble. education must do something. Education cannot be that the highest award gives us a doctorate in some university. What we need now is an education that teaches us to take care of our planet and ourselves. The problem of practical education is that the young people of the world must be taught that they are responsible for the futures they are building. And they must be educated to build a better future than their parents built. Now, in some cases, the parents are perfectly good people. But the temptations and pressures of this generation have turned young people away from the essential points and values of life. We have very much need of having education that teaches the individual to live a better life than we are living today. Education should teach him why he should become temperate in his habits, that he should devote more time to the theories and principles of good citizenship, why he must become a good family person, where he must give proper attention to the close responsibilities that nature has bestowed upon him. Nature has made men and women to be fathers and mothers, and in that nature has a plan. And if nature's plan is outraged, we have more trouble. The moment we do things badly, we suffer. And we are doing them so badly now that suffering is almost universal. So we have to start to educate people in responsibility and not opportunity. I remember an old barber I knew in New York who came over from the old country, and he came here because of the fact that America was the land of infinite opportunity. What he should have said, it is a land of infinite responsibility. Every enlargement of opportunity brings with it a corresponding increase in responsibility. And when that part is omitted, opportunity becomes a pass. It becomes something that can never be justified and never be right. So education has got to change. It has to change, and we have to help to make it change. And parents must look into these matters when they decide colleges or universities to which their children should go. Or these children themselves decide what kind of education they need. Everyone today needs an education that teaches him to be a square dealer. It needs an education that makes him know firmly and certainly that honesty is the best policy. He can't learn this from his associates. He can't learn it from society as it is today. But he can learn it when dishonesty comes down on his own head with tragic consequences. We have to get an idealism into our living. We have to realize that we are not here simply to fulfill ambitions or accumulate wealth. We are here by natural law, and the natural law says we are here to grow. We are here to become better human beings, more understanding, more enlightened, more dedicated. We are here to do things better. We are here to enrich the cultures of life. We are here to leave this world a better place than we found it. These things are not being emphasized. We are already finding case after case of public office being exploited. Well, Hammurabi had a real answer for that. And every individual who has greater privileges, greater opportunities, or greater means must share in a greater responsibility. And that which might seem only a small mistake to some humble craftsman can be a matter of the greatest importance when it is traced to a person who is educated, affluent, and in positions of authority. We have to punish that most which has the greatest knowledge. Therefore, knowledge is a responsibility. Knowledge is something that has to be used or it will be abused. And if it is abused, it will destroy the very purpose of itself. Let's go back with the theologians back in the time of the alchemists and people of this character. They said that the great textbook of nature is of the greatest importance to us all. Paracelsus said, to understand the book of nature, you must walk each one of its pages with your own feet. You've got to be part of it. You've got to learn from it every day. If you want to understand nature, walk in a garden. If you want to understand nature, climb a cliff. If you want to understand nature, look at the ocean, the sky, the motions of the planets, and realize that there is a supreme law governing all things, and that at the present time, man has been mostly a violator of that law. He has ignored it and divided up the earth to his own convenience, and by dividing it has created separateness, and separateness has ended in endless warfare and confusion. Man has simply not understood. Why has he not understood? That is probably due to an innate streak of selfishness. The mind thinking begins to think of what it can do to profit itself at something else's expense. When this starts in, it goes on age after age, and there is nothing to correct it. We used to believe that religion was the answer to any of these problems. It probably was to a measure at the time of Hammurabi, because at that time, religion was largely a means of advancing all forms of useful art and knowledge. All education was in the keeping of the priesthood. And war came, and pillage came, the old temples and the old priesthoods were dissipated. Nothing remained but inscriptions on ancient stones. Finally, the selfish and the ruthless inherited the earth. But in the ancient times, there were these things to think about, and they are still here to think about. And men like Ben Franklin thought about them. He knew many of these principles because he was quite a scholar in his own right. He knew the penalty for abuse and waste. We are not aware of that. We know that a certain amount by our schooling, but we do not realize that schooling should teach us moral integrity. We are so afraid that instruction will make us religious. Now, most people say they don't mean it that way. They just don't want it to be theological. They don't want a theological system to dominate the country or the world. Well, we can agree with them theoretically. But if you consider theology and religion as identical, you're in a difficulty. Actually, the religion is not theological. Religion is ethical and moral. And a religion is simply man's ability to understand and accept the workings of the divine principle at the source of life. Man must recognize and honor the great laws of nature. He cannot escape the law of gravity, and he will have to accept it whether he likes it or not. All through nature are laws. These laws need understanding. And one of the things that we have to finally also discover is that these laws are not blind. These laws are not just simply mechanical conditions existing in space. That behind all of the phenomena of existence is a tremendous spiritual power, a power that is always right, and against which there can be no rebellion. The rebel must inevitably and eternally destroy himself. So having accepted finally that there are rules, and that these rules are real, we should begin to teach them. We should make the importance of these rules come home to the young before they wreck their lives with narcotics. These rules should become part of our way of life, which they should not be condoned when they are broken. They should be kept, manifested, and applied. We need all this in order to bring about a harmony between the universe as it is and the world as man wants it to be. Man does not want what is best. Man wants what he wants, regardless of whether it is good, bad, or indifferent. He does not fight for principle. He fights for personal power. He does not seek the common good. He seeks the supremacy of himself over some adversary or barrier. How are we going to get him out of this kind of thinking? Well, nearly always, there has to be some kind of a precedent established. We are going to have to find places where influence in the right direction can be improved and increased. We have to have the emphasis shifted from materialism to idealism. We have to have the individual honored for integrity and not for profit. This type of thing will have to come. Now, how do we know we'll have to come? Well, we're dying for lack of it right now. And we are looking forward with great hope to the future. We believe that in the next generation, we're going to have greater emphasis upon the integrities that are important and necessary to our survival. Therefore, we must begin these integrities now. A lot of people are going to have to give up bad habits. Some are going to have to give up neglecting their families. Some of them are going to have to give up unreasonable profits. But unless everything is brought into patterns universally acceptable by nature, we're all in trouble. As long as we think that there's a profit to be taken by getting the oil out of the ground, they're going to have more trouble, because for the profit, we're wasting the oil. We say they're not wasting it. We're helping to use all these vehicles. Well, a large number of these vehicles are unnecessary. In the more than that, economy has never been the principal consideration in these matters. It is talked about, but the individual wants the big, the wonderful, powerful, and all this type of thing, and down goes that supply. Now, when it's gone, it's gone, and it's going fast. It doesn't take long for 6 billion people to use it up, and it's already in short supply in many places. We have upset the climate of the planet so badly that now we have droughts where we should have rain, and we have dust storms where we might have snow. These things are due largely to atmospheric pollution and to the use of various chemicals and so forth that are detrimental. Our foods are filled with chemicals, our lives are obsessed with luxuries, and we simply don't care. Now, if we don't care, we won't stay. Something that cares more, some little bug or bee, will take over, because we have failed completely to meet the challenge of life. Well, for years, we have had a kind of a little feeling that there were people who understood this, and we're happy to know that there are. We are not all alone in our realization of the facts of life. And many of us who have tried very hard to help to bring about a better day may live to see it. But whatever happens is, we've got to get to work and do it. We've got to make the ideal come true. We've got to realize the reality of a universal truth, a truth that is not a matter of creeds or sects or religious tolerances, a truth which is the eternal way of truth, the way of life, the way of God, the way of nature. And that these ways, all of which finally are one, have to be followed, have to be obeyed, have to be explored, have to be scientifically examined and applied. But we should always be working to find out what nature wants, not what we want. We know what we want. We've had it a long time and are in trouble for having it. But what we really need to know is what nature demands, what the universe knows to be necessary, what life requires. It requires something more than the fulfillment of the endless ambitions of little people. Now, ambitions that are unfulfilled end in neurosis. Unreasonable ambitions will ultimately be unfulfilled, so neurosis becomes widespread. Every time we are frustrated in our misdeeds, we get sicker. Therefore, we have to stop the misdeeds in order to get well. Actually, we are not in a condition where nothing is final and ultimate. As long as the human being will try, as long as he will desperately endeavor to be right in the circumstances of personal and collective existence, as long as he is fair in his weights and measures, there is a good chance that he can restore the world that he wants to have come back to him. He could have happiness and pleasure, but happiness must be harmless. Pleasures must be moderate. And the real integrity of a satisfied life is internal adjustment with truth. Wherever we love, we are drawn together. Wherever we hate, we are separated. Wherever we are suspicious, we divide. We must learn constructive relationships with each other. We must learn constructive relationships with the stranger outside the gate.